Herodias. Chapter 1. In the eastern side of the Dead Sea rose the citadel of Machaerus. It was built upon a conical peak of basalt, and was surrounded by four deep valleys, one on each side, another in front, and the fourth in the rear. At the base of the citadel, crowding against one another, a group of houses stood within the circle of a wall, whose outlines undulated with the unevenness of the soil. A zigzag road, cutting through the rocks, joined the city to the fortress, the walls of which were about 120 cubits high, having numerous angles and ornamental towers that stood out like jewels in this crown of stone overhanging an abyss. Within the high walls stood a palace, adorned with many richly carved arches, and surrounded by a terrace that on one side of the building spread out below a wide balcony made of sycamore wood, upon which tall poles had been erected to support an awning. One morning, just before sunrise, the Tetrarch, Herod Antipas, came out alone upon the balcony. He leaned against one of the columns and looked about him. The crests of the hilltops in the valley below the palace were just discernible in the light of the false dawn, although their bases, extending to the abyss, were still plunged in darkness. A light mist floated in the air, presently it lifted, and the shores of the Dead Sea became visible. The sun, rising behind Machaerus, spread a rosy flush over the sky, lighting up the stony shores, the hills, and the desert, and illuming the distant mountains of Judea, rugged and gray in the early dawn. En-Gedi, the central point of the group, threw a deep black shadow. Hebron, in the background, was round-topped like a dome. Eshcol had her pomegranates, Sorcar vineyards, Carmel her fields of sesame, and the Tower of Antonia, with its enormous cube, dominated Jerusalem. The Tetrarch turned his gaze from it to contemplate the palms of Jericho on his right, and his thoughts dwelt upon other cities of his beloved Galilee, Capernaum, Endor, Nazareth, Tiberias, whither it might be he would never return. The Jordan wound its way through the arid plains that met his gaze, white and glittering under the clear sky. It dazzled the eye like snow in the rays of the sun. The Dead Sea now looked like a sheet of lapis lazuli, and at its southern extremity, on the coast of Yemen, Antipas recognized clearly what at first he had been able only dimly to perceive. Several tents could now be plainly seen, men carrying spears were moving about among a group of horses, and dying campfires shone faintly in the beams of the rising sun. This was a troop belonging to the Sheikh of the Arabs, the daughter of whom the Tetrarch had repudiated in order to wed Herodias, already married to one of his brothers, who lived in Italy but who had no pretensions to power. Antipas was waiting for assistance and reinforcements from the Romans, but as Vitellius, the governor of Syria, had not yet arrived, he was consumed with impatience and anxiety. Perhaps Agrippa had ruined his cause with the emperor, he thought. Philip, his third brother, sovereign of Bithynia, was arming himself clandestinely. The Jews were becoming intolerant of the Tetrarch's idolatries, he knew that many were weary of his rule, and he hesitated now between adopting one of two projects, to conciliate the Arabs and win back their allegiance, or to conclude an alliance with the Parthians. Under the pretext of celebrating his birthday, he had planned to bring together, at a grand banquet, the chiefs of his troops, the stewards of his domains, and the most important men from the region about Galilee. Antipas threw a keen glance along all the roads leading to Machaerus. They were deserted. Eagles were sweeping through the air high above his head. The soldiers of the guard, placed at intervals along the ramparts, slept or dozed, leaning against the walls. All was silent within the castle. Suddenly he heard the sound of a distant voice, seeming to come from the very depths of the earth. His cheek paled. After an instant's hesitation, he leaned far over the balcony railing, listening intently, but the voice had died away. Presently it rose again upon the quiet air. Antipas clapped his hands together loudly, crying, "Manius! Manius!" Instantly a man appeared, naked to the waist, after the fashion of a masseur at the bath. Although emaciated, and somewhat advanced in years, he was a giant in stature, and on his hip he wore a cutlass and a bronze scabbard. His bushy hair, gathered up and held in place by a kind of comb, exaggerated the apparent size of his massive head. His eyes were heavy with sleep, but his white teeth shone, his step was light on the flagstones, and his body had the suppleness of an ape, although his countenance was as impassive as that of a mummy. "Where is he?" demanded the Tetrarch of this strange being. Manius made a movement over his shoulder with his thumb, saying, "Over there, still there. I thought I heard him cry out." And Antipas, after drawing a deep breath, asked for news of Alcanon, afterwards known as Saint John the Baptist. Had he been allowed to see the two men who had asked permission to visit his dungeon a few days before, and since that time, had anyone discovered for what purpose the men desired to see him? They exchanged some strange words with him, Manius replied, with the mysterious air of robbers conspiring at the crossroads. Then they departed towards Upper Galilee, saying that they were the bearers of great tidings. Antipas bent his head for a moment, then raising it quickly, said in a tone full of alarm, "Guard him. Watch him well. Do not allow anyone else to see him. Keep the gates shut and the entrance to the dungeon closed fast. It must not even be suspected that he still lives." Manius had already attended to all these details, because Alcanon was a Jew, and, like all the Samaritans, Manius hated the Jews. Their temple on the Mount of Gerizim, which Moses had designed to be the center of Israel, had been destroyed since the reign of King Hyrcanus, and the temple at Jerusalem made the Samaritans furious. They regarded its presence as an outrage against themselves, and a permanent injustice. Manius, indeed, had forcibly entered it, for the purpose of defiling its altar with the bones of corpses. Several of his companions, less agile than he, had been caught and beheaded. From the Tetrarch's balcony, the temple was visible through an opening between two hills. The sun, now fully risen, shed a dazzling splendor on its walls of snowy marble and the plates of purest gold that formed its roof. The structure shone like a luminous mountain, and its radiant purity indicated something almost superhuman, eclipsing even its suggestion of opulence and pride. Manius stretched out his powerful arm towards Zion, and, with clenched fist and his great body drawn to its full height, he launched a bitter anathema at the city, with perfect faith that eventually his curse must be effective. Antipas listened, without appearing to be shocked at the strength of the invectives. When the Samaritan had become somewhat calmer, he returned to the subject of the prisoner. "Sometimes he grows excited," said he, "then he longs to escape or talks about a speedy deliverance. At other times he is as quiet as a sick animal, although I often find him pacing to and fro in his gloomy dungeon, murmuring, 'In order that his glory may increase, mine must diminish.'" Antipas and Manius looked at each other a moment in silence. But the Tetrarch was wary of pondering on this troublesome matter. The mountain peaks surrounding the palace, looking like great petrified waves, the black depths among the cliffs, the immensity of the blue sky, the rising sun, and the gloomy valley of the abyss, filled the soul of Antipas with a vague unrest. He felt an overwhelming sense of oppression at the sight of the desert, whose uneven piles of sand suggested crumbling amphitheaters or ruined palaces. The hot wind brought an odor of sulfur, as if it had rolled up from cities accursed and buried deeper than the riverbed of the slow-running Jordan. These aspects of nature, which seemed to his troubled fancy signs of the wrath of the gods, terrified him, and he leaned heavily against the balcony railing, his eyes fixed, his head resting upon his hands. Presently he felt a light touch upon his shoulder. He turned, and saw Herodias standing beside him. A purple robe enveloped her, falling to her sandaled feet. Having left her chamber hurriedly, she wore no jewels nor other ornaments. A thick tress of rippling black hair hung over her shoulder and hid itself in her bosom. Her nostrils, a little too large for beauty, quivered with triumph, and her face was alight with joy. She gently shook the Tetrarch's shoulder, and exclaimed exultantly, "Caesar is our friend. Agrippa has been imprisoned."
"Who told thee that?"
"I know it," she replied, adding, "it was because he coveted the crown of Caligula." While living upon the charity of Antipas and Herodias, Agrippa had intrigued to become king, a title for which the Tetrarch was as eager as he. But if this news were true, no more was to be feared from Agrippa's scheming. The dungeons of Tiberias are hard to open, and sometimes life itself is uncertain within their depths, said Herodias, with grim significance. Antipas understood her, and, although she was Agrippa's sister, her atrocious insinuation seemed entirely justifiable to the Tetrarch. Murder and outrage were to be expected in the management of political intrigues, they were a part of the fatal inheritance of royal houses, and in the family of Herodias nothing was more common. Then she rapidly unfolded to the Tetrarch the secrets of her recent undertakings, telling him how many men had been bribed, what letters had been intercepted, and the number of spies stationed at the city gates. She did not hesitate even to tell him of her success in an attempt to befool and seduce Eutychius the denunciator.
"And why should I not?"
she said, "it cost me nothing. For thee, my lord, have I not done more than that? Did I not even abandon my child?" After her divorce from Philip, she had indeed left her daughter in Rome, hoping that, as the wife of the Tetrarch, she might bear other children. Until that moment she had never spoken to Antipas of her daughter. He asked himself the reason for this sudden display of tenderness. During their brief conversation several attendants had come out upon the balcony. One slave brought a quantity of large, soft cushions, and arranged them in a kind of temporary couch upon the floor behind his mistress. Herodias sank upon them, and turning her face away from Antipas, seemed to be weeping silently. After a few moments she dried her eyes, declared that she would dream no more, and that she was, in reality, perfectly happy. She reminded Antipas of their former long delightful interviews in the atrium, their meetings at the baths, their walks along the sacred way, and the sweet evening rendezvous at the villa, among the flowery groves, listening to the murmur of splashing fountains, within sight of the Roman Campagna. Her glances were as tender as in former days. She drew near to him, leaned against his breast and caressed him fondly. But he repelled her soft advances. The love she sought to rekindle had died long ago. He thought instead of all his misfortunes, and of the 12 long years during which the war had continued. Protracted anxiety had visibly aged the tetrarch. His shoulders